Hi, I decided a quick introductory note was called for, so the recordings you're about to hear were done 30 years ago, and of course things have changed since then. You'll hear me talk about using the cassettes, and of course that's not how we do it these days. It's also strange to hear me speak of Moshe as if he's still alive, because he died in 1984. He was great. He was one of a kind, and I feel very lucky to have known him. This is a compilation of volumes 1 and 2, 24 lessons from each volume. What I've noticed is that the lessons in the first volume average a little bit over 40 minutes, whereas the last 24 lessons in the second volume come in around 10 minutes shorter than that. So the second month of doing the lessons, when you're into the last 24, will require a little less time each day. I hope you have a good time with these lessons. Enjoy them and get something out of them. With that said, we're time warping back to 1979, and let's begin the first lesson.
Welcome to the Feldenkrais Lessons. My name is Bruce Holmes, and I'll be leading you through a series of exercises designed to improve your awareness of your body and also to increase the intelligence with which you use it. What follows is the best summation I've been able to come up with of the genius of Moshe Feldenkrais. Moshe is an old man. He's in his late 70s now, lives in Israel, and he's wise and witty and often a real delight to be with. I spent a month in Tel Aviv this winter watching him once more, just awed by the patience and the creativity and the intelligence and the caring that goes into his work. I can remember when we first started watching him in the class in the beginning. Often there was hardly a dry eye in the place because it seemed like miracles were being done. He's very good at what he does. And if you ever get the chance to experience him, do so, because he's one of a kind. He's very special. When Moshe works on someone, what he's really trying to do is simply to teach them about themselves. And if what he's doing is lessons, then he decided he could give the same kind of information to people through floor exercises. And these he calls awareness through movement. And that's what we'll be doing here with these cassettes. The tapes were made in workshops I give, and you will on occasion hear me calling out directions to people in the workshop. These were left in because they might apply to yourself as you do them at home. You'll also hear a lot of questions asked about noticing changes or differences in your body. You may not always notice a difference, but I don't want you to worry. It's simply that this questioning, this sensing, looking for things, trying to understand, is every bit as much a part of the Feldenkrais exercises as the actual movements. So just keep at it. There are all sorts of advantages to doing these lessons at home with the cassettes, but there is also a disadvantage, and that is that if you understand a direction differently than I had intended it, there'll be no one there watching you to correct you. So you'll have to pay attention. Really listen. I've tried very hard to make the instructions as clear and as precise as possible. But the time may come when you're wondering, have I got it right? Am I doing it right? And at that point, I'd like you not to worry about it. Just do the best you can, based on how you understand things. You will probably have gotten it right, even though you won't be sure of it. But no matter what you're doing, if you'll do it with intelligence and sensitivity and awareness, you'll learn something. So don't worry. If you experience pain when you're doing one of the exercises, take that as a warning signal. Don't push through that. These lessons are intended to be gentle. And one possibility is that you're pushing too hard. You're trying too hard. So ease off. If the pain still continues, you might want to try imagining the exercise rather than actually doing it. As you'll soon discover, you can get some of the same changes simply by pretending that you're doing an exercise. Sometimes the lessons will not take the full 45 minutes available on each side of the cassette. So often I put additional material at the end of a lesson, and I would ask you to make sure a cassette is finished before you actually shut the machine off. And finally, be consistent. I'm hoping that you'll set aside a specific time each day and make the Feldenkrais work a regular part of your day, at least for the next month. I would also ask you to review later that night or the next morning, to think back to the exercise and try and remember how it felt and what you remember about it. If you'll make the Feldenkrais method a part of your life for the next month, I think in the years ahead you'll be very glad you did. That's about all I need to say right now. Why don't you kick your shoes off and find some carpeted space for yourself? I'm here with a very nice group of people who've been patiently waiting while I explained all this, so why don't we get started? What I'd like you to do is to stand up for a second. Okay, we're going to be doing what is going to look like exercise with these lessons. Technically, they are exercises. But you all probably have a lot of preconceptions about that word exercise, and I want to examine that for a second. I want you to try an exercise with me and see what we learn from it. Stand with your feet about shoulders width apart and put your right hand on your right leg. And without letting the right hand leave the right leg, I want you to see if you can touch the floor with your right hand. And don't watch what other people do. See if you can touch the floor with your right hand without letting it leave the right leg. Okay, now take a look around. I'm seeing a number of different things. I'm seeing some people who can go straight down the front and keep their hand on their leg all the while and keep their knees straight and touch the floor, which is, to my mind, fairly impressive. I've seen a couple of people who actually went down to the right, you know, made it a little bit harder by going down the side and still managed to keep their legs straight, which is even more impressive. And there are a number of you who have cheated. You have bent knees.
I didn't say to keep the legs straight.
You know, that's true. I didn't say you couldn't bend your knees. But you all have been through high school and you've all been through gym class. And you all know, deep in your bones, that if exercise is going to do you any good, you got to suffer a little bit. We had it up on the wall in the gym class. We had, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And exercise to do you any good has to be a lot of work. So if you can do something the easy way, it's obviously no good for you. So you've got to find the hard way to do things. Do you all know that without any doubts, right?
No pain, no gain.
Okay. All right, listen. If you do that in these exercises, you will get very little out of them. There's something called a Weber-Fechner equation. This says that the more effort you do, the more work you're putting into something, the less sensitivity you'll have. If you're holding a 40-pound weight in your hand, you have to add or subtract at least a pound before you can feel in your arm that something has changed. If you're holding a pencil, a butterfly could land on it, and you'll notice something feels different. Well, people get into sort of syndromes. They're used to doing movements a certain way, and let's just suppose that they learn to do them poorly, and they're using a lot more effort than they need. Well, that increased effort cuts down their sensitivity to their body, which means that they don't have the ability, the sensitivity, the awareness to choose an easier way to do something. So they keep on doing it the hard way, decreasing their sensitivity. It's like a syndrome that it's hard to get out of. You can theorize a different sort of syndrome where you've started getting in touch with your body, started noticing changes, and you actually start taking pleasure in some of the movements. I mean, you do something and you just, that felt nice. And if you start making that kind of choice, having that kind of awareness, you're using a lot less effort, which means you're increasing your sensitivity, making it possible the next time around to choose an even easier way of doing whatever you wish to accomplish. Once you've been through the Feldenkrais work, you'll start making those kinds of choices. You start getting in touch with your body and being aware of what feels good and what doesn't. Okay. Let's go ahead and do a Feldenkrais exercise. I hope this isn't too much of a disappointment. Okay, we're going to do an initial experiment, then we're going to do an exercise, then we're going to go back and do the initial experiment, and we're going to see if anything has changed. So in the course of all this, if you're going to be scientific about it, you have to leave your feet right where they are. Don't move them. I want you to point your right arm straight out in front of you at shoulder height, parallel to the ground. I want you to turn towards your right, your whole body turning towards your right, but leaving your feet where they are. Your whole body turning towards your right, your arm turning towards the right, your head following along. Go as far as you can comfortably and see how far you can go. And pick a point on the wall beyond your hand and remember that point. That's how far I can go. Okay, just remember it. And then come on back. Good. And here comes the exercise. You people aren't going to believe how simple it is. Right arm, just the way it was, straight, parallel to the ground, shoulder height, pointed directly in front of you. Your arm is going to move towards the right side, so it's pointing off to your right as your head looks towards your left. And both those movements are going to happen together. Then you bring them back to center together. Your right arm moves towards the right side, your head looks towards the left at the same time. Now this is not oompa oompa, it's not gym class. This is to be done gently. And then bring them back to looking directly in front of you again. You're going to move both off to the side, one to each side, and then they both come back to looking directly in front of you. Arm pointed in front of you, looking ahead of you. Now do it again. Most times I give you a movement, do it again and again. Don't just do it once and then wait for the next command. I want you to do this movement 15 times. If you feel some sort of strain before you've done the full 15, then do it less. But do as many, up to 15, as you can comfortably. Do it as smoothly, as easily, as gently as you can. Try and make it a real work of art. Your arm comes to a point directly in front of you, pointed away from you. Your head looks straight ahead of you, and then the arm goes to the right while the head turns towards the left. I want this to feel nice. And when you've done it 15 times, I would ask you to turn towards your right as far as you can go without strain and see if you can go a little further than you did the first time. But don't force it. And leave your feet right where they are. Has everyone finished? Has everyone tried the initial experiment to see if there was any improvement? Okay. The second half of the exercise. The arm is going to do the exact same thing it's been doing. The head is again going to turn towards the left, but this time the eyes are going to swivel towards the right as the head turns towards the left. Fun, right? Now there's a trick to making this easy. The easiest way to do this is to simply pick a point directly in front of you, keep your eyes riveted on that point, and if you do that and move your head to the left, your eyes will automatically, without really having to think about it a whole lot, swivel to the right. So that's what I want you to do. Let's have your arm parallel to the ground, straight out in front of you.
Same arm.
Let's have the head looking to the left, let's have the arm turning to the right, and let's have the eyes swiveling to the right at the same time. I want you to do it 15 times. And when you've done it 15 times, do your initial experiment, turn towards the right, see how far you can go. Everyone done? Why don't you have a seat? Is there anyone here who didn't see any improvement at all? There must be someone.
That was very small.
Very small. Okay, good. I need to say something about that. Sooner or later, you'll do an exercise, and the person next to you will be going, wow, You're going to be lying there, and you can't see any difference at all. And you're going to feel left out and cheated, deprived. More than anything, I don't want you to worry about it when that happens. It'll happen to everyone sooner or later. You'll hit an exercise that you don't need, or it's just not working for you. You may be so good at doing that particular movement that there's no possible room for improvement. Just don't worry about it. Go on to the next one. Maybe that one will get you. For those of you who did see some improvement, how much was it? 10 degrees, 20, 30, what was it?
Mine was about 20 degrees.
20 degrees?
Yeah, 20.
A fair amount? Did it kind of surprise you? Okay. If you saw a significant amount of improvement, and it took us, how long, a minute to do the exercise? What does that tell you about the way you normally use your body? Are you in some ways perhaps limiting yourself in ways that you're not aware of, that you hadn't considered? All right, the theory here is that what we've just changed is the way your mind is functioning. The body is what we work through, granted, but what we're really trying to do is change the way your mind operates your body. It's not about flexibility, except in the sense that Newton was flexible. I mean, did Newton have a flexible body? Well, we'll never really know, and I'm not entirely sure I actually care, but he did seem to have a flexible mind. And that's what we're after here. The premise being that the way you move, the way you hold yourself, is a reflection of what's going on in your nervous system. Bodies don't generally operate without any instructions. If you see someone walking down the street and their face is going through a series of rather bizarre, contorted, and grotesque expressions, you wouldn't assume that there was something wrong with their face. True? You'd figure they just got out of the funny farm and you might keep your distance. If you learn how to hit a tennis ball, it's not your arm that changes. I mean, to some extent, your arm's just a hunk of meat. And that doesn't change when you learn to hit a tennis ball. What changes is your brain's ability to send down a series of neural firings in a certain temporal and spatial reference, and that's what you've learned. The arm doesn't learn. It's the brain that learns. It seems to me the most fascinating thing about Homo sapiens is our ability to learn. Animals rely on instinct to a great degree. You don't see a lot of inept cats. It takes a bison about 10 seconds once it's born to be able to walk. A human child takes a year before it can walk. And it's not because the kid's retarded, it's because a human child has to learn everything that went into that movement. A canary born in Japan and a canary born in England will sing pretty much the same song. A child will speak a different language. There's very little about the way you move and about the way you live your life that isn't learned. And most of the learning, especially about how we move, happens at a fairly early age through a rather haphazard system of trial and error. I would suspect that there's no one in this room that was actually taught how to move. Most of us don't have a criterion for what intelligent movement is. If we can walk across the room and we don't fall on our face, we figure we got it right. So we adopt a style of movement and we eventually put it on automatic. It becomes a habit, very much unconscious, and not something we are likely to examine. In other words, we no longer have much choice in the matter. And when you've given up choice, you've given up part of your humanity. Machines are designed not to have choice. And what makes this all the more crucial is that there's no guarantee you learned how to do anything right. You learned it well enough to get by, granted, but you could be hurting yourself and not know it. Now, the one saving grace in all this is that you can unlearn it and learn how to do it better. I'm not trying to say here that habit is the scourge of mankind. Habit on occasion is very useful. It means that you don't have to relearn a task every time you do it. But it does mean that you become unaware of a lot of things in your life. And the thing people become perhaps the most unaware of is how they use their body. If I asked you all to move a certain muscle in your back, you'd all be in stitches at the idea. Even the way you do more controlled movements is not something you understand, perhaps. It's simply something you do without necessarily knowing what you do. You've got a bunch of habits that you rely on. They're how you operate yourself. And for all you know, they could be doing you some harm. Of course, the harm takes a while. It's, you know, you're 45 years old and suddenly someone tells you you've got a deteriorated disc and you don't know how it happened. But it didn't happen overnight. It took a long time and it took a consistent policy of misusing yourself. Undoubtedly, you didn't mean to. But usually it's something you've done to yourself. When I first did these lessons, you know, I wasn't gullible. I was dead certain it had something to do with flexibility. I mean, you know, you're moving around, you're loosening it up, but brain, I mean, who are they kidding? I don't think this is about physical flexibility. We will be working through the body, it will seem like we care about what's going on in the body, but we're concerned with a different flexibility. I would say there's two forms to flexibility. One of them has to do with whether your tendons and your muscles have length and stretch to them and so on. Yoga, okay? The other flexibility is, do you know you have a hip joint? Do you know how it operates? Can you use it well? And since what you're changing then is the way the brain operates, that's a much faster change than trying to stretch out a muscle. It can happen in an instant. That's why some of these things happen so quickly. We're looking for the ability to make choices. We're looking for the ability to know what we're doing and do exactly what we want to do. We're looking for a sensitivity to our own bodies and an awareness of how to use it. Now, if all of this is true, then we should be able to do the exact same exercise you just did, do it on the left side, and get exactly the same kind of results, even if we did it purely in our own imagination. Makes sense, doesn't it? Do I see doubt? Why don't we go ahead and try it on your feet? Feet about shoulders width apart. This time we're going to use the left arm. We're going to do our initial experiment. We're going to see how far we can turn towards the left. Go ahead and do that. Arm parallel to the ground, straight out in front of you. Turn towards the left. How far can you go without forcing yourself and your feet and whatnot? Okay. Come on back. Now we're going to do 15 of arm to the left, head looking to the right. We're going to do them purely in our imagination. Okay? If you need to do one for real, just to be clear about what you have to imagine, that's allowed. But I'd like you to do the rest of them just by thinking about it. Now, imagining doesn't have to mean visualization. You don't have to be able to see 3D Technicolor movie screens in your forebrain. It simply means pretending you're doing it. Creepy, crawly feelings as if you almost were doing the movement. Go ahead and try it. When you've imagined it 15 times, go ahead and try it out for real. Now for the second half of the exercise. Good luck. You're going to be moving your arm to the left, your head to the right, and your eyes are going to swivel to the left. Now, I give you permission to do it for real once, just to be clear about what you're imagining. Arm is going to move to the left as your head looks to the right, turns to the right. And at the same time, your eyes are going to swivel to the left. The way to do that is pick a point right in front of you and keep looking at it as the head turns to the right. Good luck. Imagine that 15 times. When you've imagined it 15 times, try your initial little experiment and see how far you can go. That's called trying too hard. It's also called cheating by moving your feet, which isn't allowed. Don't force these things to work. They'll work on their own. How about having a seat when you've done it? Any questions or comments?
I only get 5% this time.
Only 5%. Okay.
I'm terrible time imagining.
You'll get better at it. Same results?
Or maybe a little bit.
Anything else?
I definitely had more of a response this time, but only after the first set, not after the second.
Okay. So you got more response by imagining than by actually doing it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had the same experience where the first one went further, but when you said, you know, think about it, I started to think about loosening up even before I started.
Hmm. Okay. Anything else?
I just think it's amazing.
Oh, well, I do too.
Could you talk a little bit about what's going on?
Yeah.
All right.
Austin.
Why does that work? Well, first of all, let's say I have a glass of water sitting beside me. Anytime you ever see someone reach for a glass of water, they will turn their head as their hand reaches for the glass of water. They will have a united, concerted effort that involves their whole body turning in a specific pattern. Their head follows the movement of the hand. Okay, that's some wired-in neural connections you've got that you always use that perhaps limit you. If you ask someone to have their arm and their head turning in different directions, you're starting to scramble a lot of circuits. And you're opening up options that the brain didn't have before. Does that make sense? You understand what I'm getting at?
So you scramble your usual way of doing it, and that allows you to do...
You open up pathways in your brain that you hadn't used before.
Uh-huh. So that when you do the same movement, it's actually...
Well, in part it's not limiting yourself. First time you were holding on in ways that were keeping you from going as far as you could. You were stopping yourself. So part of it has to do with turning muscles off that limit what you do. Mm-hmm. Part of it has to do with teaching yourself how to use more of yourself than you've been using. This will become clearer and clearer as the weeks go by. It took me 4 years to have a moment where I really felt I understood what the old man had been getting at all those years. All right. A few more words about imagining. They did some experiments with some students up in a Canadian university, and they had one group of students sit in a chair for, say, 40 minutes a day and imagine running through the woods. And they took another group, and they had them actually do the running. Now, I think it would have been a lot more fun to have been in the group that actually got to go out and run. But the group that did the sitting in the chair, imagining it, had some of the same physiological changes as the group that actually did the running. Another little tidbit. They once did an experiment with a bunch of kids, and they put them on a basketball court, and they separated them into two groups, and both groups were tested to see what percentage of free throws they could sink. Then for the next 20 days, each group practiced for 20 minutes. One group practiced by actually shooting free throws, the other group practiced by imagining they were shooting free throws. The group that did the imagining showed as much improvement as the group that actually did the free throws for real. Let's do a short little exercise now that we will come back to on another occasion, but I want to give you a touch of it right here. I want you to lie on your backs. This is something we're going to do a lot of. As you're lying on your back, I want you to notice how your back feels against the ground. I want you to notice how your shoulders fit against the ground, which parts of your spine make contact. Which parts of your hips touch the ground and which don't. And I want you to bend your knees and put the soles of your feet on the ground. Knees just up in the air a little bit. Feet on the ground. Get comfortable. I'd like you to round your back. Imagine you have a tail sticking up between your legs and someone has lifted that tail very gently, and it will tilt your pelvis so that your back rounds against the floor. You can also arch your back. You can go in the opposite direction. You can tilt the pelvis the other way, and you can create more space between the small of your back and the floor than there was originally. So I want you to go between those two points. I want you to arch your back a little bit, then I want you to round it. Arch it, round it. I want you to do that by tilting your pelvis. Now, this doesn't mean picking your pelvis up in the air. This should be a very gentle, easy motion. I don't want acrobatics. If you're having to work at it, you're doing something wrong. Very gently, you're pressing the small of your back against the floor. That's when you round your back. When you arch your back, of course, you're lifting it. And it's all done by a very small, easy tilting of the pelvis. Back and forth. And as you do it, pay attention. What else moves? How do you tilt the pelvis? Does the weight shift with your feet against the ground? What does this do to your breathing? How does the rest of your body respond to the tilting? Do you see movements in other parts of your body? Do you feel anything moving in your shoulder as you tilt the pelvis? Come to rest in the middle. Now you can also tilt a pelvis from side to side. You can lift the right hip up just a little bit and shift the weight over towards the left side. Then you can shift it back the other way. Lift the left hip up just a shade and tilt the weight over towards the right hip. Now this doesn't mean pulling the hip up towards the shoulder. It's simply a very gentle, easy tilting. Only the barest minimum of what needs to be done. Now notice that as you shift your pelvis and tilt it one way and another, that the point of primary weight bearing changes. First it's over one hip, then it's the other hip. When you were rounding your back, the weight shifted up towards the small of your back. When you were arching your back, the weight shifted towards a point down between your legs. Okay? So we've designated four points. One's up towards the small of your back, one's over towards your left hip, one's down towards between your legs, one's over towards your right hip. And what we're going to do is we're going to call those four points on the circumference of a clock. We're going to call up towards the small of the back, 12 o'clock. We're going to call over towards the left hip, let's say 3 o'clock. It's somewhat arbitrary. Down towards between your legs, you could call 6 o'clock.
Could you clarify that point?
Which point?
The 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock is what happens when you arch your back. In other words, when you're just lying with your back rested gently against the ground, it's somewhere, it's, let's call it the middle point, okay? Now when you arch your back, that midpoint shifts down towards between your legs. Now when you're in the midpoint and you simply tilt your pelvis so that your weight is over towards your right hip, we're going to call that 9 o'clock. So I want you to go from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And we're only going to work in that little section for now. We're going to go back and forth between 12 and 4, and it's going to be a curve. It's going to be a curve from the 12 position to the 4 position. And you're going to go back and forth, just trying to get very precise control over that region.
What was
the 12 is up towards the small of your back.
Arching your back upwards and downwards.
By rounding your back. 12 o'clock is what happens when you've rounded your back.
I
Next, I want you to go from 3 o'clock to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 o'clock. Then back, 7 to 6 to 5 to 4 to 3. Make it a nice, smooth, precise, round curve. Next, I want you to go from 6 to 7, to 8 to 9 to 10, and then 10 to 9 to 8 to 7 to 6. Finally, from 9 to 10 to 11 to 12, to 1 o'clock, and then back to 9. Now try it all the way around clockwise. And then change direction and go counterclockwise. Okay, how about stretching your legs out, resting? And I want you to notice how your body fits against the ground now. Does anything feel different? Has anything changed in your back? Has anything changed about the way your hips make contact with the ground? Is there any sense in which you feel somehow larger or more aware of yourself? Now I want you to roll gently to your side. And I want you to get up very slowly and carefully and easily. And I'd like you to walk around the room for a second. Does anything feel a little different than what you're used to? And then have a seat. That's enough for the first day. I hope you're beginning to suspect that you've embarked upon something of an adventure here. If you'll do a lesson each day, the changes will add up and reinforce each other, and the level of awareness and integration with which you use yourself really will change. The beauty of the Feldenkrais lessons is that they provide ideal learning situations. This is the true learning, the learning they never taught in school, about who you are and how to use yourself. Even very fine athletes can learn a lot from these simple exercises. And if you've never really felt at home in your body, the results can be really dramatic. I'm thinking of a middle-aged woman who had fallen down a lot in life, and 4 months after Feldenkrais workshop had turned into a dancer. Maybe there's a dancer in all of us. That's all for now. Take care.